Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the forthcoming P5 plus 1 talks with Iran, which many see as a last chance for the UN Security Council plus Germany to make a deal with Iran before their elections begin. Flint Leverett and Hilary Mann, co-authors of the new book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran, join us to discuss the need for the U.S. to rethink its 30-year-long failed policy towards Iran. Then we will speak with the former New York Times UN correspondent Barbara Crissett, who now covers the UN for The Nation, where she has an article, once again, Senate Republicans Reject Human Rights. We will discuss the growing number of treaties on the rights of children, women, and the disabled that the United States has signed but failed to ratify due to the rejectionist bloc of ignorant and isolationist Republican senators who see UN treaties as a plot by foreigners to impose a vast gay, feminist, socialist conspiracy on American life. Then finally, we will speak with Eric LeCompte, the director of the Jubilee USA Network, which focuses on development in relation to the international debt crisis. We will discuss the need to close corporate offshore tax loopholes that deny the United States Treasury $150 billion a year, which is a lot more than the automatic spending cuts that will take place in 2013 if Congress fails to avert the so-called fiscal cliff. Joining us now are Flint Leverett and Hilary Mann Leverett, co-authors of the new book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Flint Leverett served at the National Security Council, State Department, and CIA, and is currently a professor of international affairs and law at Penn State. Hilary Mann Leverett served at the National Security Council and the State Department and negotiated for the United States government with Iranian officials. She is now a senior professorial lecturer at American University. Their writing has also appeared in the New York Times, Politico, Foreign Policy, and the Washington Monthly, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint and Hilary Mann Leverett.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you both, and thank you for your new book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And, of course, you're both going to Tehran, are you not, tomorrow?
Tomorrow, that's right.
Well, let's begin with the context that I mentioned in the opening here, that The forthcoming round of P5 plus one talks with Iran, many see as the last chance for the UN Security Council plus Germany to make a deal with Iran before their elections begin and the holidays begin. Do you accept that window is closing?
Well, you know, it's closing because of, you know, arbitrary deadlines and frameworks that the United States and some of its partners have imposed on these negotiations. In the end, the Iranian nuclear problem is actually quite simple. If the United States was prepared to accept Iran's right to enrich uranium under safeguards on its own territory, you could have a deal in fairly short order on the nuclear issue, where you could probably get limits on Iran's 20% enrichment. You could get much more intrusive verification on its nuclear activities. But you would have to accept the Islamic Republic as kind of a normal state with legitimate interests and rights.
And this is the problem that underlies the entire debate now about the potential of negotiations through the P5 plus one, this mechanism of the permanent five members of the Security Council in Germany with Iran. The anxiety here, the urgency, is because, or it's put out, that if we don't do something now, we don't try to make a deal now, the Iranian elections will come and there will be this new year in Iran, and somehow that is going to derail any possibility of talks. This is something that time and time again permeates the American debate, that somehow the problem with negotiating with Iran is in Iran, is in Tehran, that somehow it's either the mad mullahs are either so crazy, so irrational, that we have to we can't count on them to negotiate like a rational state, or various things are going to come up in their calendar, particularly elections, which in itself should make us question this idea that there are mad mullahs there, because they do have regular elections, have had them every few years for a president since the founding of the Islamic Republic. The whole debate here is that something is wrong in Iran, something is wrong in Tehran that's going to derail talks. There's never any examination of what drives American politics to demonize countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran or Iraq before that, or even in current day terms, Libya and Syria. The issue is something here. It's about domestic politics here. If President Obama cannot get a negotiation going with the Iranians in the next few months, he has a problem domestically here, because the domestic constituencies here and the Israeli government will say, time is up. You've had enough time. We can't let the Iranians continue to progress in the nuclear program. You have to take even more coercive action, either more coercive sanctions or military action. It's a domestic problem here. It's not because of something going on in the decision-making or some irrational craziness among Iranian clerics or Iranian lay leaders.
So let me ask Flint Leverett. Is there any substance to the report that came out that Valerie Jarrett had secret talks with the Iranian officials, and that coincided, and that was quickly followed by the decision on the part of the Israelis to escalate the situation in Gaza?
I don't know if those specific talks took place that have been reported took place or not. I mean, I think it is pretty clear that There have been some bilateral contacts on the margins of various meetings where Iranian officials, U.S. officials, have been in attendance. I think that the Israelis are perpetually concerned that I think their concern is exaggerated, but I think they're perpetually concerned that the Obama administration really is going to try in a serious way to pursue a deal, because the Israelis know that the only kind of deal you could really get out of this process that would have any meaning for both sides would be a deal that actually recognized Iran's right to enrich, again, under safeguards, not building a nuclear weapon, but they do have a right to enrich under safeguards. And that's what the Israelis are out to stop. They do not want the United States, other major Western powers, to accept this basic fact of international law and international life, that the Iranians have this right, and they're not going to be bullied into giving it up. And, you know, this is something that I think the United States really has to come to terms with. For its own interests, it needs to get a nuclear deal with Iran. It needs to start realigning its relations with this important country in the Middle East. And, you know, we need to be able to separate Israeli preferences that have more to do with their own commitment to military dominance in the Middle East and Israeli security. You know, Iran enriching uranium under safeguards doesn't affect Israeli security at all. But we need to be able to sort out what our real interests are here.
Well, sorry, Hillary. Go ahead, Hillary.
Yeah, I have no way of knowing whether Valerie Jarrett engaged in these kind of discussions. I have some doubt that there would have been that kind of discussion going on. But there is precedent, and again, one of the reasons why we wrote this book, there is ample precedent of times when the United States and Iran were inching towards discussions, or actually in discussions. And I'm recalling specifically when I was an official with the State Department, then working for the White House, dispatched to go with then Ambassador Ryan Crocker to talk to the Iranians about Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda. This is in the fall of 2001, right after 9/11. We had very constructive, productive talks with the Iranians. They were critical to helping us with the strategy to overthrow the Taliban and to set up a new government in Afghanistan. And then, lo and behold, January 2002 comes. And there is a boat that sails towards the Gaza Strip with 50 tons of weapons on it. The Israelis claim, and this is a claim that's never been followed up after that, claim that that ship came from Iran. That was the basis for which President Bush then designated Iran as part of the Axis of Evil, because they were sending the ship of 50 tons of weapons to the Palestinians in Gaza, notwithstanding the fact that one of my interlocutors on the Iranian side at the time, he was the deputy foreign minister, he went on television to say, he actually went on Fox News to say that ship was not authorized by the Iranian government. He was careful to say that he could not guarantee it didn't come from anywhere in Iran, but that it absolutely was not authorized by the Iranian government. Didn't matter. They were designated as part of the axis of evil. This is the history of the relationship between the United States and Iran. Iran has consistently engaged in talks with the United States when the United States requested it, over Afghanistan, over Iraq, over Bosnia, over Lebanon. And in each case, the United States benefits from that engagement. The Iranians don't do 100% of what we ask, but they do a lot, and we benefit. But then something else happens, whether it's the Israelis, whether it's an election in Iran that people perceive as fraudulent when there's not a basis to do so, but they still perceive it. Whatever it is, there's something that periodically comes up, routinely comes up, to derail those talks. And what Flint and I argue in the book, that because of this history, it's critically to understand it as it is, not for how some may wish it to be, and then what do you do about that, where periodic talks over issues of mutual interest, that doesn't work to transform the relationship. And clearly, sanctions don't work to transform the relationship. We are convinced that military action against Iran is not going to work to transform the relationship. So what can you do? And this is where Flint and I unpack, we think pretty persuasively, the precedent of President Nixon and Kissinger going to Beijing. And there's the title for our book, Going to Tehran. That for the United States to deal with its interests in the Middle East, to save our position in the Middle East, we can't just work with Iran here or there or try to cut a deal on the nuclear issue or cut a deal on whatever issue of the day. But we have to have a fundamental realignment, a rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran that accepts it as a rational state, looking at its interests to protect them as it sees them, and that we can work with that in the Middle East to stabilize the region and restore our own position.
Flint, you're leaving tomorrow for Tehran, and my understanding is that since October of 2009, Tehran has refused to engage in bilateral talks with American diplomats, perhaps believing that that's a concession, which is pretty much the way we operate, I'm afraid. But there's been some rather candid revelations from Iranian government institutions recently talking about why Iran should not shun direct talks. So is there a breakthrough likely there, or are they going to stick with the P5+1 mechanism?
I think that the Iranians, that their position on dealing with the United States has been pretty clear and consistent for a long time, for years. They are open to improved relations. They are open to dialogue and diplomacy to facilitate serious improvement in relations, but they want to know up front at this point that the United States is really prepared to accept the Islamic Republic as a legitimate political order representing legitimate national interests, and they want to know up front that the United States is really serious about realigning relations with it. They're not interested in having negotiations just for the sake of having negotiations. They're not interested in having negotiations if they think that the United States is simply just going to keep piling sanctions on them. You know, they want to know up front that the United States is serious. So they will go to the P5+1 talks. They certainly are not, refusing to participate in the P5+1 process. And if, as part of that, the United States makes it clear that it really is interested in a different sort of relationship, that it really does accept the Islamic Republic and wants to come to terms with it as an important player in the Middle East, I think at that point the Iranians would be very, very open, very receptive to bilateral dialogue.
Well, Hillary, it appears that, at least if these reports are correct, that some government institutions are talking about why, and they have political assessments arguing that Iran should not shun direct talks. So is there a division going on there within the government? I mean, clearly there's a division between the speaker and the president.
Well, I think there is consensus that Iran should and can engage with almost any country in the world if it is to protect its own interests. Where it draws the line is anywhere where Iran would be asked to or expected to cede any of its sovereign rights. That Iran it's not going to agree to that kind of negotiation up front. In terms of what Iran should push for, what kind of deal Iran can make in the end, there's certainly discussion, debate, really vociferous debate in Iran about those kind of tactics. But the strategy that Iran is a strong country, it can and should negotiate and deal with other countries in its own interest, is something that is really put forward by the Supreme Leader, by Ayatollah Khamenei, and it's something I think every senior official follows. There's no real dissent in Iran about that. It's really just over tactics. You hear in Washington especially periodic discussion about how, you know, some days it's Ahmadinejad is the hardliner and he would never be able to deal with the United States. And then someone points out, well, you know, he actually wrote a 20-page letter to Bush. He actually wrote a congratulatory letter to President Obama upon his first election. Then people say, well, then maybe the issue really is the Speaker of the Parliament, or it's this person, or it's that person. There's a constant attempt in the United States, particularly in Washington, to try to read the tea leaves as if it's a very opaque system. People analogize it, these kind of critics analogize it to the Soviet system. But it's not really opaque. If you listen to, read, talk to officials, talk to a range of people in Iran's political class on the political spectrum, and take what they have to say seriously, not as if they're being forced to say something, you can really understand their strategy. You can understand where they're coming from, and the strategic determination to be a very strong, independent country. The problem, I think, on our side, why we try to always see where there's some daylight, see where that this person is competing with that person, is that we're very reluctant to accept that Iran could be a strong, independent, not secular, not liberal, but still legitimate political entity. That is something that is deep in American culture, is very, very hard to accept. So I think rather than there being so many divisions on the Iranian side that people put out there paralyzes the Iranians, that, in fact, is not the case. And we document exhaustively in our book the number of times that the Iranians have engaged with the United States. In the 1980s over Lebanon, we actually have a name for it. It was called the Iran-Contra scandal. The Iran-Contra scandal failed not because the Iranians were divided, not because the Iranians couldn't come to the table, but because our own officials skirted Congress and broke the law by diverting proceeds from the sale of weapons to Iran to Nicaragua. I mean, it sounds crazy now in retrospect, but that's the history. The Iranians came to the table with us in the 1980s over Lebanon. They then helped us to get weapons to the Muslims in Bosnia in the 1990s. I then worked personally with them as an official in the State Department and in the White House with a small team of American officials to deal with Afghanistan, the problem we were facing there after 9/11 with Al-Qaeda. Every single time the Iranians have come, they were not paralyzed by internal conflict. The internal conflict was here. It's the opposition that I had when I was in the White House from my superiors or people who worked for Vice President Cheney trying to undermine what Ryan Crocker and I were doing with the Iranians. It wasn't a problem on the Iranian side.
Well, Hillary, didn't after the U.S. Invasion of Iraq in the war that was largely prosecuted, or at least engineered in many ways, by Dick Cheney, and of course President Bush was the president, notwithstanding, my understanding is that shortly after Baghdad fell, that the Iranians sent missives through, I think, the Swiss to the White House saying that we would like to talk and everything's on the table. And that includes this nuclear program that we're so exercised about. And apparently Dick Cheney basically said, we don't talk to evil, and scrubbed the whole, and just rejected it out of hand. Is that true?
Well, we were having quieter talks. Ryan Crocker and I, and a couple of others in the State Department, were having quieter talks with Iranian officials up until the invasion of Iraq. Then, there were some issues on our side. The invasion happened. My superiors, including Vice President Cheney, thought we were riding high with the invasion of Iraq and the fall of Baghdad. But instead of just cutting off those talks clearly in a transparent way, there was a bombing, an al-Qaeda bombing in Riyadh and in Casablanca, twin bombings at the exact same time in May 2003. Then Defense Secretary Rumsfeld said, and of course this has never been followed up on or checked, that there was some intercept from somewhere that showed that one of the bombers in Saudi Arabia called someone in Iran and said the job was done. That was then used to cut off talks with the Iranians that Ryan Crocker and I were having over Afghanistan and al-Qaeda and trying to have them over Iraq, cut them off and really destroyed them for years to come. In, I think, an attempt to try to rescue the talks, the Iranians remarkably put in writing, for one of the first time that I had seen, put in writing how instead of just dealing with Afghanistan or Iraq or al-Qaeda, these issues in an isolated way, that the way to restore, to have trust, to restore the relationship between the United States and Iran on a productive level of equals, would be this broad-based, comprehensive engagement, like what Kissinger and Nixon did with China. And, you know, we called it the grand bargain. I actually wrote the memo. I was, by this point, on the policy planning staff at the State Department, wrote the memo to then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, including this note from the Iranians that laid out what this comprehensive discussion, negotiation, and eventually grand bargain would look like, and advocated that we should take it. Flint had the opportunity to meet with a very senior official from on the Iranian side at about that same time in Athens, and I included his minutes from that meeting. I gave it to my boss, who gave it to Colin Powell. I saw Colin Powell a couple weeks later, and even though the memo was longer than what he normally would read, and let me know that, he thought it was an excellent memo, but that he couldn't sell it at the White House. I later learned that he couldn't sell it, but in fact what Cheney put forward was not just that Cheney, vice president, he's the boss, but that if Colin Powell, if the State Department would just let this Iran issue go for a while, then Cheney would look more favorably on the six-party talks restarting over North Korea. Well, Powell took that deal, and those talks proceeded. The talks with Iran went into the deep freeze for years. And the Iranians, you know, just got stronger and stronger in Iraq. We went deeper into a quagmire. Finally, again, 4 years later in 2007, by this point, my colleague Ryan Crocker was our ambassador in Baghdad. He was allowed finally to start talking to the Iranians again, but over an extremely narrow, restricted agenda. And by this point, the Iranians thought that wasn't really serious. They would protect their own interests in Iraq, help us where they could, but basically protect their own interests. And that's one of the reasons why today they are focused on this kind of comprehensive approach where they're not just strung along and then cut off and punished when either there's a change of administration here or something else comes up.
I thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's
really
been our pleasure.
It. Yes.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett and Hilary Mann Leverett, co-authors of the new book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Flint Leverett served at the National Security Council, State Department, and CIA, and is currently a professor of international affairs and law at Penn State University. Hilary Mann Leverett served at the National Security Council, the State Department, and negotiated for the U.S. government with Iranian officials. She is now a senior professorial lecturer at American University, and their writing has also appeared in the New York Times, Politico, Foreign Policy, and the Washington Monthly, among other publications. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the rejectionist bloc of U.S. senators holding up treaties involving the rights of children, women, and the disabled that the United States has already signed.
بشکن 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 بش